help recalling how it felt to kiss, hold you tight. Oh, how can I forget you, girl? When there is always something there to remind me. Always something there to remind me. I was born to love her, and I will never be free. You'll always be a part of me. Whoa, whoa, whoa.
This is InfoTrack, the weekly show with information you should know. Here's what's happening on this week's show.
Many medical doctors are highly susceptible to burnout, and those suffering the greatest burnout are reportedly residents who are training to become doctors. But it can impact physicians at any stage in their careers.
Burnout is a huge problem in nurses and administrative staff, in researchers even, and then across the career stages of physicians. No one's untouched by burnout.
Then, recent research reveals a possible link between cyberbullying and eating disorders. We'll have the story.
One of the differences with cyberbullying to in-person bullying is, you know, oftentimes these can be anonymized and, you know, not necessarily somebody you're going to have to see the next day at school.
Those two interviews and more are coming your way on this week's show. Stick around. InfoTrack begins right after this.
iPhone 15 Pro on Verizon.
It's your last chance to trade in any iPhone in any condition for the new iPhone 15 Pro with titanium and iPad and Apple Watch SE, all on us with Unlimited Ultimate. Go to your local Verizon store now. iPhone requires Unlimited Ultimate plan first. Service plan required for iPad and Apple Watch. $999.99 device payment or full retail purchase with new smartphone line required first. Less $1,000 trade-in slash promo credit. Up to $459.99 device payment purchase with new line on eligible plan required per Apple Watch or iPad. Less up to $459.99 promo credit per device applied. 0% APR. Additional terms and conditions apply.
At Grainger, we're for the ones who specialize in saving the day and for the ones who've mastered the art of keeping business moving. We offer industrial-grade supplies for every industry with same-day pickup and next-day delivery on most orders, all backed by real people ready to help. So you can get the right answers and products right when you need them. Call, clickgrainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Imagine getting ahead of your irritable bowel syndrome with constipation or IBS-C by treating it with Linzess. Then you could start proactively managing your constipation with belly pain and get ahead of your symptoms. Talk to your doctor about Linzess, linaclotide. Linzess is a prescription medicine that treats IBS-C in adults. It's not a laxative. It's a once-daily pill that helps you get ahead of your symptoms. It's proven to help you have more frequent and complete bowel movements and helps relieve overall abdominal symptoms, belly pain, discomfort, and bloating. These symptoms were studied in combination, not individually.
Do not give Linzess to children less than 2. It may harm them. Do not take Linzess if you have a bowel blockage. Get immediate help if you develop unusual or severe stomach pain, especially with bloody or black stools. The most common side effect is diarrhea, sometimes severe. If it's severe, stop taking Linzess and call your doctor right away. Other side effects include gas, stomach area pain, and swelling.
Imagine, what could relief from IBS-C mean for you? Talk to your doctor and say yes to Linzess. Learn more at Linzess.com or call 1-800-LINZESS.
InfoTrack, the weekly show with information you should know. Here's your host, Chris Whitting.
It's a serious problem that can affect all physicians, but especially those in training to become doctors. The problem is burnout, but a pilot program to reduce physician burnout has promising results. With more, here's InfoTrack's Roy Mackey. Roy?
Thank you, Chris. Our guest is Tyra Feinstad, MD, associate professor in the University of Colorado School of Medicine, and she was a co-author of the study. Dr. Feinstad, before we get into the results of this pilot program, tell us a bit about what causes burnout in medical residents or healthcare workers in general, and why it's such a serious problem.
Burnout is highly prevalent in all physicians, but especially in our trainee population. And burnout, as we measure it, really breaks down to 3 subscales: emotional exhaustion, and so that's being truly exhausted by your work, perhaps being overworked, having some hyper-responsibility. You can see why this all probably got worse during the pandemic. Depersonalization happens when you sort of become numb or callous, feel like you're maybe a bit of a cog in the wheel. And then low personal accomplishment, feeling like, gosh, this really isn't what I thought it was going to be like. Becoming a doctor, I thought I was going to feel more confident, more competent, maybe have more fun, just that realization that it's not how you thought it would be. And so all of those are present in much of the workforce, and especially so in physicians and in physicians in training, where they're working 80 plus hours a week in specialties they may or may not want to end up in. And then, of course, all the pressures of the pandemic.
Your study focused on physicians and medical residents, but this burnout problem applies to many different professions within healthcare, right?
Oh, absolutely. Burnout is a huge problem in nurses and administrative staff, in researchers even, and then across the career stages of physicians. No one's untouched by burnout.
I would suspect that this trend would result, or maybe is a reason for, staffing shortages in hospitals and medical facilities.
I have to imagine that that's true. I mean, on an anecdotal level, if you talk to any particular staff member or healthcare worker, I think they'll loosely cite burnout as a reason that they're thinking about leaving, and there's national descriptive data to support that as well.
You also found that women are hit harder by burnout than men in health professions. Why do you think that is?
Absolutely. I think in short, it's because of sexism, and in long, it's because women are trying to fit in a place where they've been told culturally or by society that they don't necessarily belong. So the pressure to outperform their male counterparts is high. Also, women are known to take on a disproportionate amount of childcare or home duties outside of the workforce, which also was compressed during the pandemic. There's many other reasons, like microaggressions or biases that they endure at work, either from patients or from colleagues, unfortunately, that probably do contribute.
So tell us a bit about this pilot program.
Yeah, so Better Together Physician Coaching is a group coaching intervention that is completely digital. It's a 4-month program that Dr. Adrian Mann and I created back in 2020 as a solution for burnout and other indices of well-being that we were seeing our residents be heavily impacted by. And we always say that we created this program as a gift to our prior selves, kind of what we wish we had during residency. It's a place where you can come and show up as yourself and listen to your colleagues be coached by professional physician coaches around any topic that's pressuring you at the moment. It corresponds to 16 weeks of online content around issues that trainees have been bringing up for decades, really, and certainly more in the recent years, things like perfectionism and imposter syndrome, approval addiction, confidence, how to deal with feedback, things that can be soul-crushing on the inside and maybe invisible on the outside. We're sort of bringing all of those to the forefront in this program.
And your program produced some measurable results. Tell us what you found.
Yeah, I'm glad you asked. You know, we did actually have a pilot here in 2021, which showed an improvement in 100 residents at the University of Colorado in an intervention group compared to a control group in burnout, in imposter syndrome, and also in self-compassion, and not at some other outcomes that we looked at. I believe that's because we weren't powered to find the full impact of our program. So this study was so important because it was done nationally, so the results are generalizable. Our population matches the national demographics of residents and fellows, women residents and fellows across the country. It also was done in 26 different graduate medical education programs. It was over 1,000 trainees across 19 states. And we ended up improving every single outcome we studied. So all three subskills of burnout, moral injury, self-compassion, imposter syndrome, and flourishing. We took those doing pretty good to even doing better. So I feel certain in saying this program can improve measures of well-being and distress sort of across the continuum for residents and fellows.
Why was the group nature of your coaching so important?
There have been actually quite a bit of research studies showing an impact of one-on-one or individual coaching. It certainly can be impactful. We actually found a greater impact across multiple more domains of distress and well-being with the group nature of our coaching. And I think that is for a few reasons. One of them, I think it's more accessible. It's less scary to sign up for a group coaching program because perhaps you don't have to participate to begin with. And so the bar to participate at all is just lower. And then secondly, the impact of getting coached in front of a group and then hearing your colleagues be coached in front of a group is enormous. Personally, the times that I've been watching somebody else be coached are more impactful to me because not only am I hearing that lesson or internalizing that reframe or having that epiphany moment for myself, but I'm also seeing somebody else normalizing my own challenges in front of me. And if I can extend self-compassion to that person, then perhaps I can extend it to myself as well, is why I think the group nature works. It's also incredibly connecting. Connection was a huge theme that came up in a qualitative analysis we did back in 2022. Even though we're completely digital and these participants may never meet each other, they feel bonded. They feel like they have a community with each other over the things that they're bringing vulnerably and sensitively.
I would think that seeking out help like this would be important to do early, as soon as someone is starting to feel burned out. Is there a breaking point where maybe it's too late?
Gosh, I hope not. You know, we have actually expanded. So Better Together Coaching now serves medical students. I agree with you that the earlier, the better. We also serve faculty among all career stages. And in fact, just completed a pilot randomized controlled trial here in faculty where we coached junior faculty, faculty in the mid stages of their career, and even some senior or retired faculty, all who felt a benefit and were impacted positively. So I don't think that it's too late. And also, certainly, we know the sooner the better. These thought patterns that create the culture of medicine that now is being called toxic, I think, begin very early on in training. And so the sooner we can end the suffering, the better.
If you were offering advice to a recent graduate who is just entering the medical workforce, all bright-eyed and bushy-tailed, what final words of advice would you offer to them?
Oh, gosh. I would want them to know that they are entering a field that is riskier than almost any other field for burnout, and not just burnout, but it's riskier for a pathologic behavior of being mean to yourself. And so the biggest piece of advice I would give them is please, please be kind and be gentle with yourself in these upcoming years, because the thought you believe that you have to be hard on yourself in order to do well is not true and ultimately is self-sabotaging.
Dr. Tyra Fainstad, Associate Professor in the University of Colorado School of Medicine, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
And for InfoTrack, I'm Roy Mackey.
Next, the link between cyberbullying and eating disorders. That story, straight ahead.
There's more InfoTrack coming up. Stay tuned.
We're for Washington. We love Febreze's new scent.
Refresh and energize.
So much, we made a song about it.
This feeling inside, refresh and energize. It's a mood, it's a vibe.
iPhone 15 Pro on Verizon.
It's your last chance to trade in any iPhone in any condition for the new iPhone 15 Pro with titanium and iPad and Apple Watch SE, all on us with Unlimited Ultimate. Act now. Visit Verizon.com. iPhone requires Unlimited Ultimate plan first. Service plan required for iPad and Apple Watch. $999.99 device payment or full retail purchase with new smartphone line required first. Less $1,000 trade-in slash promo credit. Up to $459.99 device payment purchase with new line on eligible plan required per Apple Watch or iPad. Less up to $459.99 promo credit per device applied. 0% APR. Additional terms and conditions apply.
Denise has been playing jazz for 40 years. Last concert, one of the musicians fell sick with RSV. Respiratory syncytial virus, or RSV, is a highly contagious virus that can lead to breathing problems. This time, she's choosing to help protect herself with Pfizer's RSV vaccine, Abrysvo. Abrysvo is a vaccine for the prevention of lower respiratory tract disease caused by respiratory syncytial virus, RSV, in adults 60 years of age and older. Abrysvo is not for everyone and may not protect all who receive the vaccine. Don't get Abrysvo if you've had a severe allergic reaction to its ingredients. People with a weakened immune system may have a decreased response to Abrysvo. The most common side effects are tiredness, headache, pain at the injection site, and muscle pain. Ask your pharmacist or doctor about Pfizer's RSV vaccine, Abrysvo, respiratory syncytial virus vaccine. For full prescribing information, please call 1-844-989-7284 or visit Abrysvo.com. Brought to you by Pfizer.
You're listening to InfoTrack. To learn more about our guests or listen to past shows, visit InfoTrack online at InfoTrackRadio.com. Once again, here's Chris Whitting.
Does cyberbullying affect adolescents' risk of developing eating disorders? Recent research looked into the question, and joining us to talk about this study is Jason Nagata, MD of the University of California at San Francisco. Jason, before we get into the results of your study, tell us how you gathered the data for your research.
This study comes from the Adolescent Brain Cognitive Development Study, which is actually a nationwide survey of early adolescents who are started off at 9 to 10 years old and have been followed every year since. And it occurs across 21 different sites in the U.S. and has nearly 12,000 teenagers who are being followed.
And briefly, tell us the results of your study on cyberbullying and eating disorder symptoms.
Yeah, overall, that we found that about a tenth of these early adolescents reported being cyberbullied, and experiencing cyberbullying victimization was associated with eating disorder symptoms, including worrying about weight gain, self-worth tied to weight, binge eating, and also distress with binge eating.
And your study mentions that cyberbullying, as you say, often focuses on body appearance and weight. What is the long-term impact of this targeted bullying, would you say, on an adolescent's mental health?
Yeah, I think that there's a lot of impacts of cyberbullying. First of all, it's important to note that certain populations are more likely to be cyberbullied. So one of our earlier findings was that, for instance, LGBT youth are three times more likely to be cyberbullied than their heterosexual peers. And so there are vulnerable populations who tend to be bullied more. And I definitely think that that discrimination and bullying can lead to worse mental health. And we're specifically looking at how that could impact eating disorders. You could imagine how, you know, if somebody gets bullied, especially about their appearance or weight, that could lead to lower self-esteem and then lower body satisfaction. And these teens could then resort to unhealthy weight control behaviors like vomiting or taking laxatives or binge eating to try to compensate for some of these feelings.
Eating disorders reportedly have a high mortality rate among psychiatric disorders. What early signs could be observed in an adolescent that might tell us that there's a more serious disorder possible?
Warning signs for eating disorders include when a teen becomes preoccupied with their appearance, body weight, size, food, or exercise in a way that really worsens their quality of life. They may withdraw from usual activities or friends because of concerns with body size and appearance. And I think it's really important also to note that even though I think the typical stereotype is that eating disorders only affect girls, actually eating disorders can affect people of all genders and all races and all ages and all sizes. And so one of the issues is that we don't often recognize eating disorders in populations outside of girls.
One of the interesting things is that the bullies themselves might be at risk of developing eating disorder symptoms. Is that correct?
Yeah, we also found that to some extent, cyberbullying perpetration was also related to binge eating, distress with binge eating, and worrying about weight gain or self-worth tied to weight. I do think that it's a complex relationship, and it certainly is individualized for each teenager. But in general, there is some overlap with perpetrators and victims. So, you know, you could imagine that somebody who experiences victimization could then pass it on to another peer and sort of extend that vicious cycle of bullying. And especially, I think, with online interactions, you know, a lot of times these interactions on social media can be from a fake account, they can be anonymous. And so you could imagine how teenagers experience bullying and then the next day or even right after then go and bully someone else. And I think one of the differences with cyberbullying to in-person bullying is, you know, oftentimes these can be anonymized and, you know, not necessarily somebody you're going to have to see the next day at school.
I think you touched on this, but how were the participants in the study asked to assess their own relationship with their weight and self-worth?
In every year of the study, the teenagers and also their parents are asked about many mental health symptoms that align with the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual. That's sort of the Bible for mental health conditions. And they are asked basically the questions that align with the diagnosis of an eating disorder. And so all of those symptoms that I had mentioned about, you know, being worried about your weight or tying your self-worth to weight or having compensatory behaviors to prevent weight gain, those are all some of the criterion for a diagnosis of, say, anorexia nervosa. And so all of these teenagers are basically asked the questions that align with the criteria for eating disorders. And then also their parents were asked those symptoms as well.
I see. Our guest is Jason Nagata, MD of the University of California, San Francisco. And we're talking about a study that links cyberbullying with developing eating disorders. Jason, how can your study's findings influence public policy? What recommendations would you make for public health initiatives?
There's a few lessons from these studies. I think first, it's important to note that both cyberbullying and eating disorders or eating disorder symptoms are relatively common among teens. So it's important that teachers and parents and pediatricians are aware that these experiences are relatively common among teens, and you know, they might consider asking about that, especially pediatricians at, you know, routine health visits, and provide guidance as needed. Since teenagers are exposed to so much exposure online, including potentially cyberbullying, it's important that schools, as part of digital literacy courses, provide some guidance as to how teens can prevent cyberbullying, both avoiding hateful and discriminatory content themselves and also not perpetrating it themselves. Because I think that because these teens are so likely to be exposed to it, I think we have to start providing some guidance as to how teens can deal with this new online environment that we're experiencing.
And we've been talking about teens. Could this impact also younger kids, maybe under the age of 12?
This current study only started with 9 to 10-year-olds. They are under 12. But I think you're right that more and more, as kids have access to screens and computers online earlier, they could be exposed to potentially cyberbullying even earlier. And it's interesting because technically, in order to obtain a social media account these days, you are supposed to be 13 years old at a minimum. But there's not really robust age verification, so any kid can just make up their age and create an account. And so one thing that we found from this study was that about a fifth of these 9 and 10-year-olds already had social media accounts, although technically they're not supposed to. So I do think you're right that kids are getting exposed to potentially cyberbullying and other exposures online, even at ages before they're technically allowed to.
What message would you convey to parents who may be listening who wonder if their kids are being cyberbullied, what they can look for in their children?
I think one important thing is that actually one of the biggest predictors of children's screen use is actually their parents' screen use, even though we may not think it. And so I think it's important that parents role model the screen behaviors that they want their kids to also exhibit when they're online. So if you have rules about, you know, limiting screen time, you know, at meal times or before bedtime, it's important that you practice what you preach. And even though we're really focused on cyberbullying among children and teenagers, there's a lot of hate that's going on in social media that's even perpetrated by adults. And so I think that it's important that adults, you know, role model these behaviors for their children. Beyond role modeling, I do think it's important to just create an open environment at home where your teenagers might be willing to talk openly about some of these issues. So if they do experience hate or discrimination online, they might feel able to share with you, and you sort of can encourage them to share so that you can either report the perpetrator or help support them if they're dealing with any of the mental health consequences of bullying.
Jason Nagata, MD of the University of California at San Francisco, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
You're listening to InfoTrack, a production of Syndication Networks.
I can't wait for what's next. Even with higher stroke risk due to atrial fibrillation and a regular heartbeat not caused by a heart valve problem, Eliquis, apixaban tablets, reduces stroke risk. It's the number one cardiologist-prescribed blood thinner.
Don't stop taking prescription Eliquis without talking to your doctor, as this may increase your risk of stroke. Eliquis can cause serious and, in rare cases, fatal bleeding. Don't take Eliquis if you have an artificial heart valve, abnormal bleeding, or have antiphospholipid syndrome. While taking, you may bruise more easily or take longer for bleeding to stop. A spinal injection while on Eliquis increases risk of blood clots, which may cause paralysis, the inability to move. Get medical help right away for unexpected bleeding or unusual bruising, or if you have tingling, numbness, or muscle weakness. It may increase your bleeding risk if you take medicines such as aspirin products, NSAIDs, SSRIs, SNRIs, and blood thinners. Tell your doctor about all planned medical or dental procedures. Learn more at Eliquis.com or call 1-855-ELIQUIS.
Now, InfoTrack continues. Once again, here's Chris Whitting.
A recent study suggests there's a connection between cyberbullying and those experiencing eating disorder symptoms. InfoTrack's Roy Mackey is back, and he has the story. Roy?
Thanks again, Chris. Our guest is Ana Lorena Fabrega. She describes herself as an edupreneur. She's the author of The Learning Game, teaching kids to think for themselves, embrace challenge, and love learning. Ana, I think the basic premise of your book is that we need to question pretty much everything about how we've educated kids for decades. And there are plenty of stats that illustrate that a frightening number of our students are not proficient in reading or math. What is the biggest message you're trying to convey to parents and teachers?
We are still using a system that was built 200 years ago for very different purposes, and it's no longer serving the generation of kids that it's serving. And so we now need kids that are creative, that are problem solvers, that can think for themselves, that can break from the pack and do things differently so that they can get to creative and breakthroughs. And that's just not happening with the kind of education that we're providing.
I understand you attended 10 schools in 7 countries growing up. How did that affect how you approach education?
Yeah, so in order to sort of survive this flawed system, and given that I was pulled out of the schools at random times or sometimes had to skip grades, by the time I was 14, I had attended 10 schools. So I picked up on this game of school, which in the book I describe as what kids have to do in order to navigate the system and check all the boxes and pass the tests, but not necessarily learn anything that will stick or find the things that make them amazing humans. And so my real learning was happening outside of school, when I could really get to the things that excite me, when I could be exploring without fearing that somebody was going to judge me with a bad grade. And that's what I call the authentic real learning. And that's the kind of learning that prepares you for the game of life. And so I argue that kids who pick up on this school game don't really graduate prepared to know how they can contribute to the world and the things that they can do or the things that make them unique. And it's a world that's constantly changing, that's very chaotic. And so all this content that we keep delivering in schools are from outdated curriculums that may or may not be relevant in the future for jobs that haven't even been invented yet. And so I would argue that a better way would be to teach through projects or to find alternatives outside the system that teach kids the soft skills that we know they're going to need in this future that they're entering.
Could you give us specific examples of what you would like to see change?
Instead of focusing so much on grades and using the standardized assessments to see if kids are learning and having them memorize all this information, what if we gave them an open-ended problem or a project, and then they're going to naturally need different topics and different resources and different tools? And so that's the moment that you introduce these tools and this knowledge, and you help them find the knowledge that is a click away on the internet So instead of delivering information just in case, just giving them what's practical to them and what they can apply right away to the real world, we know that knowledge decays really quickly, and what kids don't use in the productive world in the next 14 days, they forget. And so instead of having them, again, cram all this information, actually start with projects. We also know that when we segregate topics by subject, it's really hard for information to stick because learning is interconnected. So instead of every 45 minutes ringing a bell and switching from science to math to reading and interrupting the learning, if kids learn through a project and they can see how the different topics fit within each other, then that's a much better way to actually learn. Then also this notion of having the teacher deliver all the content, it's a way better approach is when kids actually have autonomy over their learning and they are in charge of what's going on, and the teachers are more of a facilitator. And so giving kids choices and giving kids more movement and giving kids more autonomy are things that would really make a difference as they learn. And then there's the part of, instead of segregating them by age and into grades, you know, when in the real world do you only interact with people your age? What we see when you have mixed age groups, which is a way that I propose is a better way to learn, you have older kids teaching the younger kids, you have younger kids wanting to imitate the older kids so they can actually do a lot more than we would think they're capable of, just because you remove that speed limit that we create with grades. And so instead of focusing on, you know, remediating their weaknesses, we can focus on actually doubling down on their strengths and the things that they're already really good at, instead of only focusing on always trying to label them and focusing on all the negative things.
Ana Lorena Fabrega, author of The Learning Game, Teaching Kids to Think for Themselves, Embrace Challenge, and Love Learning. Thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
And for InfoTrack, I'm Roy Mackey.
And that wraps up this week's show. InfoTrack's executive producer is Randy Meyer, and I'm Chris Whitting. Thanks for listening. We hope you'll be here next week for another edition of InfoTrack.
You know all the words, so crank it up and sing along.
Crank it up.
The Valley's fun music, 105.7 CFW. 1057 CFW. CFW.
I'm gonna meet ya, I'll meet ya, yeah.
This is fun music for Eau Claire, Chippewa Falls, and Altoona. This is 105.7 CFW. Seven CFW.
She's got Chippewa Valley weather.
I'm meteorologist Rodney Price. A mix of clouds and sunshine today. Northwest winds, highs in the lower 30s. Tonight, skies turning mostly clear. We'll drop to near 20 degrees. But with the help of sunshine Monday, we'll make it up into the mid-30s. Colder on Tuesday with sunshine, blustery winds, and upper 20s. It's 24 at our studios.
CFW.
This is 105.7 CFW.
Snapshot and it's frozen.
Attention. If you're a person who dislikes fun, please tune away now. Are they gone? Yeah, good. Okay. If you live in the Valley, you can pick up oldie stations and kids stations. And, well, we thought it was time for some fun. You know, this world doesn't have enough fun in it. So we've put together a radio station that has a great time playing the music you grew up with. And we sprinkle in a good dose of fun. Nothing wrong with fun. Life's too short. So come on along with us and enjoy the fun ride on the Fun Music Station, 105.7 CFW.
105.7 CFW, the Valley's Fun Music, is broadcast from the Bug Tussle Studios. Bug Tussle, keeping you connected to the world around you.
Bug Tussle, we're out there.
Snow brings thoughts of ways to stay busy in Wisconsin during the winter. And if you anticipate hitting the slopes, are you surprised to learn there are more than 36 ski resorts across the state? It ranges from Wilmot Mountain, which opened in 1938 in Kenosha County, to Mount La Crosse Ski Area with one of the longest runs in Wisconsin. Granite Peak offers 58 runs outside Wausau, and Wild Mountain Ski Area and its seven lifts near Hayward. Now, do you know which of those resorts sits on the highest slope? The answer coming up. Recreational skiing started in the Midwest. The Lost Ski Areas Project reports the first